everybody, and welcome to the Community Geek Podcast. This is Gregory Russo, Community Manager for CommunityGeek.com, joined today by Darren Goh from Feverbee.
Hey, Greg, how you doing?
Doing quite well, quite well.
Good. Well, I'm sat here doing a very classic English thing. It's about 25, 26 degrees in the UK, blisteringly hot outside, and I've got a good old classic English cup of tea.
Oh, very nice, very nice.
And it's going down a treat.
You need a cuppa.
Absolutely. You got the slang. I love it.
I'm doing a very American thing and sipping on some Coca-Cola. Classic, baby.
That's good. So, hey, whatever works for you, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm not much of a coffee or tea guy, actually. I would fare horribly in Britain.
Yeah, I think it's part of the foundation of our economy. So, yeah, you wouldn't be a part of the evolution of the British Empire any further, I don't think.
All right. Well, we've got some exciting site news. Mostly the fact that our community has grown quite a bit this week. I want to give shout outs to Amanda Swan, Ainsley Hunter, and Steve Bridger, as well as Christy Fedura, who we talked about on the cast last week for running the London Community Managers event. They've all joined Community Geek since the last podcast, and I could not be happier.
Totally agree, and they're four really good people in the industry as well, so it's a real pleasure to have them join Community Geek and add some real value to the great stuff that's already going on in there.
Yeah, and we could still use some more people. You know, if you've been thinking about Community Geek, come on in.
Yeah, we'd love to have you.
So, Christy, when we brought her up last week, we talked about her in the context of her running the Community Managers Networking event in London. And I thought that was a good excuse to talk about how to run offline events in your community in general. What are some good ways to do it? We found a good article on Eventbrite, and Darren, why don't you introduce it?
Yeah, it's a really good little piece, actually. It's 7 tips to improve event networking by building online community. Really interesting read, and I'm sure we can stick it up on the site so people can have a look at that as well. It's written by
Sarah with no last Sarah. Name.
With no last name. But it's a guest post that comes from Jennifer Pitts, who's a director of marketing at Pathable. For those of you who don't know, Pathable provides event apps and does like mobile conference apps and websites for trade shows and this kind of associations and events and that. So pretty experienced person. But the kind of points are quite interesting, and it's something, I mean, it's great. You mentioned Christy there. Christy does some community manager meetups in London as well. I know she's keen to grow that. She does a fantastic job of getting that up and running. But it also reminded me of two chaps called Lawrence and Jürgen, and they run a company called Social Media London. And the tips kind of resonated with me because I'll read through the 7 tips quickly and just tell you guys about what they've been doing. So the tips are to get started early with what you do so you can kind of maximize the success of the community. The second one is to obviously be involved. So, you know, if you're the host and the facilitator of the event, to kind of be seen and to be there to propagate it and push it on. Obviously to look at recruiting sponsors and exhibitors. Obviously that's a big part of moving things forward. Leveraging your speakers, encouraging personal meetings, and enticing attendees to participate. And finally, just keeping it going, you know, once it's over, don't stop. And the reason that it reminded me of the Social Media London guys is they've pretty much been through this exact process. They started really small, I think maybe a couple of years ago now, and literally just booked a free space somewhere. I'm really keen to get, you know, social and community people in the same place. They did some outreach, sent out some invites, got a few people along, and they've sort of over about, I would say about 6 or 7 different events now, they've built a real following. And this is exactly what I think they've done to get there. You know, they got started early. They launched the online stuff. They got people connected. Whenever they run an event, they're always there. They're very present. They're very keen to network and, you know, get people together. For me, the sponsors and exhibitors have come forward a big step. They've now used the O2 workshop in central London a few times, which is a great brand name to be associated with. And I think just lends the event credence. And the speakers have upgraded over time as well. You know, they've had people from Hootsuite and Adobe and Social Bakers and some, you know, some really good key speakers. And they've managed to build this event over time really well. And these 7 points kind of really resonate with me. So I don't know what you think about that, Greg. I mean, have you got much experience with other people that have done this type of stuff? And is it the sort of thing that resonates with you too?
Actually, I don't have too much experience doing offline events myself, but I am familiar with people that have done it. And a lot of these do ring true, particularly leveraging your speakers. So if you bring in a speaker, it's a big deal. It's usually one of the main events of your meeting. Like, so obviously people are coming to meet other people, but you're congregating around this event, and sort of the event's eventiness is who's coming, what are they talking about, getting all these experts in one place, getting all these people in one place, and creating an experience around that. And having speakers do stuff beforehand for you, like get discussions started early, make themselves available for a bit of a pre-talk or hype thing, or do an AMA. Have them provide resources, perhaps, that they're going to discuss. Have them get posted up so your members can see them, and that resource is then part of your community. Or just have them help promote your event. Promoting your event when they're speaking at it is also promoting themselves, so make sure they have the relevant information if they want to tweet about it. They're tweeting the right links, the right hashtag, that kind of stuff. And encourage them to be social about it and be talking about it. Kind of hype your event up, because they want people to come see them, but those people that come to see them are also going to experience the rest of your event as well. So that's pretty key.
Yeah, I totally agree. And something that I remember, Jennifer York from Hootsuite did a really good talk. And one thing she did was she, beforehand on Twitter and across several communities that I was involved with, she did a little bit of build up and dropped a few ideas of what she was going to talk about. And she was really good also at following up after the event. So the Social Media London guys did a great job of making sure that whoever's speaking at their events are always connected to the people that come to the events. She followed up really well on Twitter, you know, so some of the topics that had come up, they tend to limit the session to about 45 minutes plus questions. She was just really popular, but she took the time afterwards to continue discussions, continue to outreach, to make sure that the questions that people had, if they didn't get a chance to ask them there and then, or perhaps sometimes they, you know, on the train home and something had occurred to them, she did a really good job of connecting. And I just thought it was a really interesting example of where, you know, how community online and offline fits together and how valuable it is to the industry.
Yeah, one interesting thing I want to touch on real quick before we move on is the tip 3, I believe, recruit sponsors and exhibitors to join, not just recruit them to help support the event, but also join your community and help drive engagement. But a key thing they highlight here is to make sure when they join, they're not doing it to just sell, because that'll in fact turn off community members and turn off attendees. They don't want to feel like they're being marketed to in their own community. But what you can do is have those people start conversations about things that they do. So, for instance, if you're being sponsored by, Google, they could talk about not their latest product necessarily, but perhaps if they're mainly interested in talking to your event about Google Glass, perhaps your community is around virtual reality or something like that. They can talk about these augmented reality applications in general, and perhaps talk about new advancements in the industry or potential ways to monetize it, that kind of stuff, without directly selling their product. You want to have a genuine engagement.
I think that's absolutely right. And the last point on this list, which is keep it going. I've been to so many events or, situations where the event is fantastic and there's a really good, you know, feel good factor there. And this is something that I know Rich talks about as well. You know, when the doors close, when everyone puts down their social beer and walks out again, you know, what happens then? It's really, for me, it's probably the most integral part of it. The effort that goes into setting up, running an event, getting the right people there, making sure it's popular. All that promotion is wasted in a second if you don't follow it up. You know, people like to see slides from the event. They like to see keynote speeches. They like to see pictures from the event. You know, just a sense that community runs further than the 45 minutes, 1 day, 2 days you were there. And I think that's, for me, is kind of the key point to this all. You know, if you don't do that, then the effort can often be lost in the first place.
Absolutely. All right, our second story is a new community for artists called ArtistBee.com. And what I thought was really interesting about ArtistBee is that it's got a lot of the classic features of community, places for people to discuss and meet, but it also has an aspect of, because it's for up-and-coming artists, small-time artists, a way for them to showcase their art and sell their art directly through their profiles, which I thought was super awesome. And to support some of those features, you can connect through not just like your location or traditional social networking, like who's friends of your friends, but you can also take a look at their genre or exhibitions they've done, artists that have done similar exhibitions, things like that, which for an artist site is a great example of some community-specific features that really speak to not just good social networking practices in general, but specifically target and enhance the experience of the community this is intended to be for.
Yeah, it's a really interesting piece. It reminded me a little bit of DeviantArt when I first read it. Just that kind of ability to drill down and be quite granular in terms of what your interests are. And when you find a great artist that you really love, it's great that they've put a platform and a procedure in place so you can start to connect to other people that like that artist. You know, sometimes some of the best art is found by relating it through community and someone throws up something similar. And the reason this really resonated with me is we live in a little leafy suburb of southwest London. And when we first moved here about 5 years ago, there were a lot of three or four art shops on the high street. And over time, we've gradually seen them close. And we've always thought it was a shame. We've bought one particular piece about 2 years ago from one of the art shops. And kind of part of the reason sometimes is that when we walked in there, people were kind of very self-conscious. And I think with art, because sometimes it can feel like a very exclusive thing, there was no conversation within the room. You know, it was almost like a library. It's quite silent. You know, if you tried to talk to someone, it didn't feel very natural. And I think with online, this is a way for people perhaps to get over the phobia of something that traditionally is seen as a little bit highbrow, and really start to connect with other people that are really interested in it. And it sort of takes away that top layer. So it's a great example for me of how community is being leveraged in the way it should be leveraged in an environment that people feel comfortable to connect and find interests that they really like.
Definitely. And there's some really good incentives for the artists to join in there. Not as an only another way to sell their art, but it's a way to sell their art without any commission fees, which is pretty important in the art world, because that's usually a way that people make money off the artists that they're selling in those art galleries.
Absolutely. And the one thing they do, which I think is quite cool, is you can either choose to buy an original piece, obviously if you can afford it and you really, really love that piece. But also there's the option to have a reproduction sold and sent to yourself, which, like, for me, it makes art really affordable. How many artists or art places have you ever walked into and you thought, you know, that £700 painting is beautiful, but I can't afford it. It would be great to have a cheaper reproduction of that. And I think that's, you know, that it definitely has a place in the art world, and I really like that about it, that it's making art accessible again for a different reason. So yeah, it's a really important thing, Greg. I agree with you.
Yeah, not just accessible, but original art pieces accessible. Like, I'm not a huge art guy, but I do notice when you go into, say, an art place at the mall or something, it's often sort of mass-produced reproductions. They're fairly generic. Some of them are quite nice, but they're still, like, you can kind of tell that they're fairly general. They're made for a general audience. There's not a lot of love or passion put into that. But this is for original artists to make reproductions of their own work that's not, say, picked up and distributed nationally necessarily. This is still coming from a small, intimate place. And I think that's a really valuable service that you don't really get too many places.
Yeah, and I think that's to be applauded as well. You know, there is a lot of mass-produced art. I guess from the artist's point of view, to be able to have that control of your work and not to find it, you know, reproduced everywhere or on various image sites or whatever, is a really important thing. So it's a really cool place. People should definitely check it out and have a look.
Yep, so if you're big into art, that's artistbe.com, artistbe.com. We'll have a link to the article in the show notes, of course.
I should also point out that is in no way connected to feverbee.com.
Right. Just the one E and less Greg and Darren on that site. But who knows? Maybe Darren will go in there and buy up everything.
Hey, it could be our next community venture. Who knows?
All right. And for our final story of this podcast, we're going to talk a little bit about Facebook's change to their policy regarding young children as members. they're very keen to have people as young as 12, maybe even younger, join up on Facebook, and this caused quite a bit of discussion on Community Geek as to whether or not the automated parental controls they were going to put in were effective, and what the practical and ethical concerns would be of having children at such a young age involved in an online community like Facebook. Darren, being a parent himself, I'm sure has quite a bit of insight onto this topic, so I'll let him kick it off.
Yeah, this is a fascinating one. So we're only new parents. Our daughter's only coming up 14 weeks old. But when you go through the whole parenting process, it is something you discuss at length, you know, especially as our children will grow from, you know, as soon as they're conscious, really, it'll be an online digital environment for them. And one thing it reminded me of was when we were, well, when my wife was pregnant and when we were doing our research, we came across a book called French Children Don't Throw Food by Pamela Druckerman. Now, and I'm not a massive advocate of people reading every single bit of literature on the internet or all the books. I think, you know, you have to sort of take a moderate approach. But one thing this did do, it talks about in the French culture, how they set parameters and boundaries that children grow up in. And within those parameters and boundaries, they allow children to do effectively what they want. And what it does is it teaches children how to set their own boundaries and parameters. And it just resonated a bit with what Facebook are trying to do, because I think the discussion quite a lot of the time with this type of thing is how much parenting is too much parenting, you know, especially at the sort of 12, 13 year old age. Your child is going from, you know, being a real child into being a teen, into developing traits that are going to lead them through adulthood. And it's really a question of how comfortable should you be and what the parameters should be when you set controls on children in online environments. It's a fascinating piece, actually. I genuinely love more people to come over to Community Geek and get involved in that discussion, because it's just one of those things that, well, I mean, for me as well, it would be hugely beneficial. But I'm a big believer in setting boundaries, but allowing children to have a certain amount of freedom within that. But at the moment, I don't know what those boundaries are going to be and how far I should set them and what I should allow my daughter to do. It's just a really interesting topic of conversation. What do you think about that, Greg?
Well, I think it's interesting that, you know, my parents wouldn't know a Facebook privacy control if it slapped them in the face, you know, but parents that are raising kids now, like yourself, you're much more aware of the technology. You'd be able to make more use of, say, oversight tools, so you could set those boundaries and have them actually be monitored and enforced effectively. My generation, you know, if we wanted something on the internet, we'd just figure out a way and go and get it. And in general, I don't think that privacy controls or parental controls are terribly effective. Even back in the day when it was, you needed to put in a code for your, I think it was Sega Genesis or some certain cable channels, they had those V chips, so you couldn't watch like PG or PG-13 programs. I knew kids would get around that stuff all the time. I think it's less about the technological control and more about your familiarity with the technology, what's possible, what are the dangers that need to be looked out for, and you maintaining a good relationship with your children so that, you know, you set those guidelines out for them, and a bit more of an educational component and a guiding component than a finger wagging, putting police tape across a certain port of the internet kind of thing. And Ainsley Hunter made a pretty interesting point about this, and that she feels like she needs to maintain a better relationship with her child, because at the end of the day, her behavior on the internet is the mother's responsibility, not Facebook's responsibility. So rather than rely on Facebook for any kind of strict technological control, having her as a parent be able to set boundaries and make her child aware of what the risks might be, at the same time have a good enough relationship with her that if her daughter ever did run into a problem, that she would feel comfortable and know enough to come to her for, you know, more guidance or some advice, and trust her opinion when she gave it. So I'm not a parent, so I don't know, but that sounds right to me.
yeah, and I think the thing is as well, you know, when you're talking about this stuff. The issue you just raised on whose responsibility is it? You know, there's a wealth of cases all across the world where an independent third party gets the blame for something that an action a user has taken. I mean, the sort of classic example going back was always the McDonald's had to put "this is hot" on a cup of coffee because, you know, they're the facilitator, if you like, of the coffee, and yet the person drinking it burnt themselves, and there's a big court case ensues. And I think when it comes to things like parenting on the internet and control as well, there is a big question over whose responsibility is that. So from my point of view, of course it's my responsibility to make sure that I guide my child properly. I make sure that parameters are set. You know, I'd like to think that I take use of technology to set the parameters and to work out how they can interact with community and people that are in the world. But by the same measure, you know, where does Facebook in this case's jurisdiction lie? You know, should they have to, if they want that audience, you know, you have to ask potentially what is the benefit of them bringing that audience in? You know, is if they're going to benefit from potentially ad revenue or whatever it might be, where does the line get drawn? And I think that's something for me that I'll be looking very closely at as we, and the other thing is my daughter's going to grow up in a digital world. I think I kicked off this segment by saying that, but the world has changed dramatically, you know, in the last 20 years in terms of, you mentioned PG and PG-13. I'm pretty sure that when I was 13, which is a few moons ago now, admittedly, but what content was available at 13 then is completely different to now. And the flip side of that is there's such a great variety of information. Should, you know, there's some great communities out there for educational tools. Should my daughter be prevented from those educational tools or those groups on Facebook or whatever it might be that can help her learn and develop as a person, you know, versus the protection issue? So it's a fascinating area of discussion, actually. And I think for communities, it might become more relevant the more that children are connected to online communities when they can use it to learn and develop as well.
Well, in the States, we have a law called COPPA, which is the Children Online Privacy Protection Act. And it does lay out some legal requirements as to what that responsibility is. But usually I'm not sure the exact language of it, but the effect of it is that any children that are underage and want to get involved in, there's like a legal requirement as to how you handle their personal information. It's considered more sensitive than an adult's information because they're not considered of legal age to make decisions about revealing their private information. So there's a lot of requirements that involve parental consent or to inform the parent, things like that. Facebook's motivations for why they want the kids, I think that's pretty clear. If you know anything about Candy Crush, they want kids to come onto Facebook. They want them to get involved with these third-party apps, and they want to be able to make revenue because those kids will play those apps, play those games, and they'll make money off of it or make money off the app providers that are creating it. I know parents that allow their kids to play those kinds of games on their own Facebook accounts already. So having the kid have their own profile, you know, there's not that much of a leap for that. And if legally it's these parental controls that they're putting in are determined to fulfill their requirements under COPPA, at that point you're really just talking about not what their legal responsibilities are, but what are the perhaps ethical, or if you want to talk in a larger social context, where the division of responsibility is between the parent and the provider, which is something that, you know, it's a lot harder to exactly figure out than to just look at the law and say, oh, well, that's legal, that's not legal. Then you go into, well, that's wrong, not wrong, or that's your fault versus this is my fault kind of stuff.
But do you know what my real concern is?
Yeah, go for it.
And I'll be totally upfront with this. My real concern is that my daughter ends up in a world of stuff that I don't understand, and I become my parents. So at the moment, right, it's Farmville, it's Candy Crush, it's all that stuff. I'm not sure I completely understand what's going on there at the moment. I definitely don't understand Minecraft, but I'm pretty sure that by the time my daughter gets to an age where she's into all this stuff, it'll just be, she'll be telling me this stuff, and I'll just be nodding with a vacant expression on my face, and probably at that point reaching for another classic cup of English tea.
I can't even imagine when I assume I will be a parent at some point, and yeah, that is a troubling thing. I'm thinking back to my mom, who just this year learned how to text message. Yeah, if that runs in the family, who knows? It's one of those things, like, you could never even imagine a lot of the technology we have right now when I was a little kid, and I'm not that old. So I can only imagine, given how quickly technology is accelerating, what kind of crazy stuff is going to be going on. It's sort of weird to think how, you know, your technology is going to be looked at as like the rotary phone in a couple of years, and the music you're listening to is going to be on the oldie station one day.
Next Feverbee community support group for disaffected people that can't figure out what the hell's going on in the world. So that's where we're heading towards here, Greg.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're not getting any younger, so I guess we'll wrap it up for this episode of the Community Geek Podcast. Thanks for joining us. Now, check out all the articles. We're going to put them in the show notes. If you want to join up for Community Geek, their discussion to the Facebook children stuff or just children online communities in general discussion will also be linked there, so you can go right to that. And we'll catch you next week, as always.
Yeah, it's been a really good discussion today, so have a great week, everyone. Hopefully loads of talking points, but definitely come over to Community Geek and tell us why we're right or wrong, or, you know, whatever it is you want to say. There's some great stuff going on in there right now. And have a good community week, I guess.
Yep. Enjoy yourselves, everybody. Have a cuppa.